today, we take a look at Greek civilization writ large. This civilization didn't just stop in the ancient world. It continues to live on to today. Every time you meet somebody who is a Greek-speaking, a native Greek-speaking person, you have somebody who is directly connected to the song culture that we're studying in the ancient world. And that's why the title of today's lecture, which is like a riddle when you first see it, is Odysseus and Saint Elias. And my subtitle is a look at continuities and discontinuities in Greek heroic traditions. Because every time we talk about continuities, we have to keep remembering the flip side, which is that there were all sorts of things that became disconnected from the ancient world. And one of the big factors in discontinuity between the ancient and the modern world has to do with Christianity as a world, a thought world that supplants a lot of the things that we're considering in this pre-Christian era that we're studying. Nevertheless, when you get down to the nuts and bolts of how the ancient Greeks actually worshipped heroes, and this is something that I started emphasizing already in the very first lecture, and that you may want to start reviewing in the expanded lecture notes on the website for the first lecture. This historical fact that the ancient Greeks worshipped heroes in institutions that we describe as hero cults does have a lot to do with the Christian transmission of aspects of Greek religion. And some of this Christian transmission, as we'll see, doesn't strike us as Christian at all, because there's more of the ancient world than the Christian world in it. That's definitely going to be the case with Saint Elias. You will see also when we start discussing the nuts and bolts of how people worship heroes, and that will happen next week in section, and we'll give you some very good guides for the historical background on hero worship, you'll see that a lot of things that you and I think of as Christian practices really had all sorts of pre-Christian origins, specifically origins in hero cult. My favorite example is the veneration of relics. That is to say, when you hear about pious Christian practices of venerating the bone, let's say, of a saint, you will be interested to see that the veneration of bones of heroes is very much part of hero cult. That will actually come up in today's lecture, which will have in it a key word that was used by people who were worshiping heroes, a key word that you are discussing this week in section. And that word is olbios, O-L-B-I-O-S, which we can loosely translate as blessed, if you're initiated into hero cults, or well-off, wealthy, if you're not yet initiated. The skill of being able to get it, of being able to read something in an initiated way versus an uninitiated way, is itself a matter of judgment. And look at the first word, which is the key word for the lecture today, krisis, which I define for you as judgment or crisis. And in fact, the English word crisis comes from krisis. And this is an abstract noun, krisis, derived from krino, meaning judge, distinguish, make distinctions between a surface meaning and a deep meaning. And then what it takes to make that distinction between a surface meaning or a deep meaning, what you need to make that distinction is a criterion, number two, which is a criterion. That's our borrowing for judging, distinguishing, making distinctions. And if you're in the frame of mind where you want to be doing this kind of judging between what's the meaning on the surface, what's the meaning underneath the surface. You have to be kritikos, or critical. And that has two senses, is that you're criticism related, you're ready to be critical, but it's also crisis related, as when you say this is a critical moment. And that's what we've been seeing with greater and greater regularity in this course, which is that the act of reading is not passive. You have to be engaged with what you're reading. You think you're judging what is being read, but in a sense, that reading is judging you as well, because you have to have all of these prerequisites, all of these requirements in order to get it, in order to make the right decisions. I said to you already at the very beginning of the course that this is a course that's easy in terms of how much reading you have to do. If you compare it with a course, I don't know, on the Russian novel, where you'd be reading maybe 10 times as much. But what you're reading is constantly testing you, just as you're trying to test it. And we've seen those three criteria, the mental, the moral, and the emotional, that it takes for you to understand. In today's lecture, this crisis of reading, this critical moment that happens every time we read, I will try to translate in this broader framework of Greek religion through the ages. But let's start again where we started when we began the Odyssey, and that's the first couple of lines, number four, where the performer prays to the Muse, who is the goddess of absolute memory, of total recall, and the poet says, "Tell me, O Muse, of that many-sided hero who traveled far and wide after he had sacked the famous town of Troy. Many cities did he visit, and many were the people with whose customs and thinking, nous, he was acquainted. Many things he suffered at sea while seeking to save his own psyche and to achieve safe homecoming, nostos, of his companions." Let me focus, 4a, on verse 3, that Odysseus saw the cities of many humans and came to know their nous, came to know how they think. Every community he went to had different values, different culture, different song culture. And by learning about their values, what was he also doing? Learning about his own mind, which is why I think that the problem in the original Greek, where you can't tell whether it's his nous or their nous, is something that's built into the original Greek. It's deliberately ambiguous because he's both learning about the diversity of humanity by visiting one city after another, seeing all these different customs, but at the same time, his own mind is becoming more and more capable of seeing things in a broader humanistic way. And 4b, that the goal of the hero in the Odyssey is to win as his ultimate prize, what shall we call it? His own life, if we look at psyche in terms of what your psyche means to you when you're alive, but also his own identity, so to speak, after death, which is threatened by disembodiment from the self. And you might say that the big problem in the Odyssey, the big mental problem, is how after death you can achieve a reintegration of the body that you treasured so much while you had your breath of life, how you can reintegrate that with your identity as a sum total, as something that happens after your whole life has been told. There are two ways to think about the ending of the Odyssey. One is to look at the happy ending, if I can say it that way. At the very end of the Odyssey, Odysseus has killed the suitors. He has been reunited with his wife, which is a key to his integration as a king and to the integration of the society. He's also reunited at the very end with his father, which means he connects with the program, so to speak, of his ancestors. So everything seems to come together, and you have a kind of coming full circle. But the Odyssey has it both ways. It has an ending that is both circular, which is what we see at the very end of the Odyssey, with reference to Odysseus in the ancient Greek world, but also the Odysseus theme as it survives even till today in the song culture of the Greeks, in the living song culture of the Greeks. So here we are, number five, in Hades, the realm of the unconscious, the realm where sleep, death are equivalent, and Odysseus interviews the psyche of a seer who has a special gift. This psyche has consciousness in Hades even before he gets to drink blood. That's a very big deal, as we'll see when we meet in section next week, where you'll see that the nuts and bolts of hero cult is that if you want to make contact with the spirit of the dead hero, you have to pour the blood of a sacrificial animal, preferably a ram, if it's a he hero, or a you, if it's a she hero, into the ground, and then the blood will activate for a few moments the consciousness of the dead hero who is down there underneath our earth. And at that point you make contact, mental contact with the hero. And at that point the hero can communicate from the realm of the ancestors to the present. But in most situations this can only happen if you pour the blood of a ram, let's say. And if you simply say, oh, please appear, please be conscious, it won't happen. You have to have the right ritual mechanism. Tiresias is an exceptional heroic spirit because he seems to be turned on, so to speak, his consciousness is turned on in Hades round the clock, and it doesn't have to be activated, it seems, by blood. So Odysseus comes to this shade, this exceptionally conscious shade, and look at where it says 100, line 100. The shade talks back to him, and the shade says, you want to know, said he, about your return home. Now, I wish I could show this to you in Greek, because in the original Greek, the very first word that Tiresias uses is nostos. So it's nostos that you're looking after. And then what he does, Tiresias, is he predicts what will happen to Odysseus after he gets out of Hades, after he gets out of this sojourn in Hades. And he says, essentially, what I just already recapitulated for you. I already told you the happy ending. Gets reunited with his wife, destroys the suitors, gets reunited with his father. Good enough? But then, Tiresias' story keeps going. It doesn't stop. It's open-ended. And that's what can happen with a linear narrative. And you and I have already been exploring how, depending on where you end a story in a linear sense, the story can have a happy or sad ending. So in this one, if you think of westerns where the cowboy rides off into the sunset, and I like the fact that you say riding off into the sunset in the context of a western, which means the far west. In this case, the story keeps pushing ahead. It doesn't stop there. It almost insists on seeing what happens at the point where the hero finally dies, which you don't get to see in our Odyssey. But in this prophecy, as I say, you're pushing the end of the story beyond where our own Odyssey will end. And strange story, because after, you know, he kills the suitors, he gets reunited with his wife, he gets reunited with his father, he decides that he has to go on another journey. And this time he has to go as far as possible, stretching the limits of his own experiential world. And we've seen him as the star of a story about a sailor. So guess what? He now has to go to a world where people don't even know what a sailor is, where people have never experienced the sea, the experiences of the sea, like seafaring and all its dangers. he has to, so to speak, push his existence to a point that defines his very identity as the main character of a story of a sailor, of the story of a pilot who finds his way, of a person who orients himself by being a good pilot. So you see where it says 118? You just take up the story where Odysseus kills the suitors, and where our Odyssey ends, and where this prophecy keeps pushing ahead. When you get home, you will take your revenge on these suitors, and after you've killed them by force or fraud in your own house, you must take a well-made oar and carry it on and on till you come to a country where the people have never heard of the sea and do not even mix salt with their food, nor do they know anything about ships and oars that are as the wings of a ship. And then this consciousness in the realm of the unconscious, this psyche of Tiresias, goes on to say, I will give you this certain token, and the word is sema, and we already know that's the video equivalent of what we're reading, which is Hymnos. And there's like a threat which cannot escape your notice. And then here's the sema. And of course now we know we have to have all these qualifications in order to understand it. A wayfarer will meet you and will say it must be a winnowing shovel that you have got upon your shoulder. On this you must fix the oar in the ground and sacrifice a ram, a bull, and a boar to Poseidon. Then go home and offer hecatombs to the gods in heaven, one after the other, as for you yourself. Death shall come to you from the sea, and your life shall ebb away very gently, when you are full of years and peace of mind, and your people shall be prosperous. And look at the word, olbior. There's your mystical word. There's your word of initiation with the two levels of meaning, the surface and the deep. All that I have said will come true. Now, if you compare the words of Tiresias here, predicting what will happen beyond the Odyssey, I'm looking at 5a, with the version that Odysseus himself tells Penelope after husband and wife are finally reunited, there's a little variation there that holds our attention. There, it's not just taking the oar, which is like, may I say it this way, a symbol of the sailor in the sailor story, and traveling further and further inland until people don't recognize the oar as an oar. This time, it says specifically, or should I say Odysseus says specifically, I'm traveling in one city after another. So it's a very good way to appreciate what has happened in Odyssey 1, line 3, where we saw that the story of Odysseus is traveling from city to city and thereby, in effect, enhancing his own nous. And so the key, as I say in 5a, is variety and how variety can enhance the depths of one's nous, one's ability to read experience. And look at 5b. Odysseus, by virtue of traveling throughout the cities of humankind, comes to know nous. And again, I come back to the question, whose nous is it? And my only answer, the only answer I can come up with, is it's not only the people who are in all these various different places, it's his own nous. Later on, next week, but let's just say soon, first day of December we meet, we will see a film of Kurosawa's where you actually have exactly what Tiresias says in 5c, I will give you a certain sema, and you cannot have lethe about it, you cannot blank out about it. There will actually be in that film that we will see later on in the course, 5d, a gravestone marker for a journey of the soul. If you flip the page to 6, you will see that in the original Greek, when Odysseus reaches that mental point where people can no longer recognize an oar because he's gone so far inland that people don't know what a sea is, what they mistake the oar for is a winnowing shovel. And as I say in number six, it's a mistake to translate that, as some translators do, as a winnowing fan. Because the whole point of this is that a winnowing shovel is supposed to look exactly like an oar. The only difference is that you use it for something completely different. Now maybe we all need to get initiated on what winnowing is. Is that all right? I know some of you are initiated already, but well, let me do it, okay? Which is, you imagine a harvest. And it's nice to be talking about this now because in this part of the world, now is the harvest. But in as far as ancient Greece is concerned, this would be mid-July. And let's say you're harvesting wheat, okay? The wheat that is harvested is on a big pile. And that pile will have the grain of wheat surrounded by the husk of the wheat. And winnowing is the process where you take a winnow shovel and you toss these grains of wheat into the air in such a way that even the slightest breeze will blow the chaff, the husk, off to the side, and then the grain will fall back more or less straight down, okay? And you keep doing this, and this is very hard work, and you keep doing this and doing this and doing this until you've separated most of the chaff from the grain, most of what is non-genuine from what is genuine, most of what is false and misleading from what is true, from what is the genuine article. And the time you toss it up in the air and the wind blows the chaff aside so that the grain can fall down, that moment is a moment of krisis, so to speak, a moment of crisis where you have to separate the chaff from the grain. You can think of this as, you know, these horrible stories about the kind of anxieties that you have in a job where you have apples and oranges coming down a chute and you have to put the apples on one side and the oranges on the other side. But suppose it's not apples and oranges. Suppose it's not sheep and goats. Suppose it's, how shall I put it, angoras and the other goats. And you have to separate the angoras from the other goats. This is the kind of crisis situation that we're talking about here. And that is what a winnow shovel is. So now think about the logic of this coincidence of opposites. You're a sailor. You're taking an implement on your shoulder. And if you're on the seacoast, everybody knows that this is an oar. You take it further and further and further inland, okay? And then you reach a point where people don't live by the sea, so for them it's no longer an oar, it's a winnow shovel, a winnowing shovel. But here's my point to you. As far as you're concerned, what is it? Because you knew that it was an oar back when you were on the seacoast. Now you're inland, and now people take it as a winnowing shovel. Which one is it? It looks exactly the same. It's just that in different places, it's different things. So could I just paraphrase the Odyssey story of Odyssey, book 1, line 3, once more? He went from one place to another, and he came to know the different noos of different people. And the noos of some people is that, oh, this is a oar. The noos of other people is, this is a winnowing shovel. But what about my noos? If I travel from one place to another, what does that do to my noos? Except that it expands it. It makes it possible for me to see that what's an oar in one place is a winnowing shovel in another place. And then the question is, how do I know which one it is? That's the crisis. That's the crisis of reading. That's why you need criterion. And that's why you have to be critical. And in a sense, what you have here is a symbol for the very enterprise of reading, which is what we've been doing. And you know it's hard, you know that it's a struggle each time you do it. You almost can never be comfortable and passive about it because you always have to be engaged. And in that sense, couldn't you say that the entire Odyssey is a sema, so to speak, for our own journey through this Odyssey, and how we have to get the right message, as it were. I'd like to take this moment to give you a preview of the film I'm showing tonight in Boylston Auditorium at 8 o'clock, which is The English Patient, and which is an amazing exercise in how to read a message in different ways, and to understand that only a traveler, only somebody who wanders from place to place, can finally understand, in a sense, what his own mind is about. I'll give you two clips. The first one is what you see as the credits start rolling, and you hear a very exotic song, and I bet you won't know what it is. And I wouldn't know what it is if I didn't happen to be Hungarian. And I remember when I first saw this film, and I was just watching this, and there's a paintbrush, a Neolithic paintbrush, I think it's a Neolithic paintbrush, painting these beautiful red figures of swimmers who are sort of traveling from one place to another. And suddenly, wham, it hits me that the language I hear is Hungarian. Why am I hearing Hungarian? Not only that, it's a Transylvanian dialect of Hungarian, which is a very isolated culture. Their song culture is all about wandering, all about being lost, all about trying to find your way. And then guess what? It's a lament. It's a lament of a woman who is simultaneously singing a love song. And the way it goes is, love, love, accursed love. And now I'm really excited because I thought I was seeing a movie about the English patient. I knew it was roughly about the desert and about World War II, but what does a Hungarian have to do with it? Well, it turns out there's this disoriented Hungarian who is a key figure, and he has to find meaning to his life. And so then you will see another scene where he falls in love with this woman. How does he fall in love with the woman? Because the woman tells the story of Croesus, which we're reading in section this week. So this is a movie that is not only, shall we say, tangential to the course. This movie is about our course, in the sense that this movie tells you the story of the Croesus episode that we're discussing in section. So if you'll sit with me, this will take a little more than 5 minutes. You'll pick up the mood, and I hope this will inspire you to come tonight at 8 o'clock. So here it goes.
King insisted that he would find some way to prove beyond dispute that his wife was fairest of all women.
I will hide you in the room where we sleep, said Candelus. Said Candelus.
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 Candelus tells Gyges that the queen has the same practice every night. She takes off her clothes and puts them on the chair by the door to her room.
And from where you stand, you will be able to gaze on her at your leisure.
And that evening, it's exactly as the king has told him. She goes to the chair, removes her clothes one by one, until she's standing naked in full view of Gyges. And indeed, she was more lovely than he could have imagined. But then, the queen looked up and saw Gyges concealed in the shadows. And although she said nothing, she shuddered. And the next day, she sends for Gyges and challenged him. And hearing his story, this is what she said.
Off with his head.
She said, either you must submit to death for gazing on that which you should not, or else kill my husband who has shamed me, and become king in his place. So Gyges kills the king, marries the queen, and becomes ruler of Lydia for 28 years. The end.
What is this?
It's a folk song.
Arabic.
No, no, it's Hungarian. My daughter sang it to me when I was a child growing up in Budapest.
Beautiful.
Mm. Never means love. And the stories, well, there's this Hungarian count. He's a wanderer, he's a fool. And for years he's on some kind of a quest for who knows what. And then one day he falls under the spell of a mysterious English woman, a harpy, who beats him and hits him, and he becomes her slave and he sews her clothes.
What?
Oh, he's beating me.
Bastard. You bastard, I believe you.
I claim this shoulder blade. No, wait. I want another.
I want this place. I love this place. What's it called? This is mine. I'm going to ask the king permission to call it the Olmashi Bosporus.
I hope you are going to the ownership. Will you stay tonight?
Maddox knows, I think. He keeps talking about Anna Karenina. I think it's his idea of a man-to-man chat. That's my idea of a man-to-man chat.
This is a different world, is what I tell myself. Different life. And here I'm a different life.
Thank you. Yeah, you are a different wife.
Different world, all right. It's traveling from one world to another. It's wandering. On your website, I actually have this lament recorded in a more ethnic setting, and then the movie version of the lament as sung by a Transylvanian singing artist. But wait till you see the translation for this lament, and the fact that everything that the lament has in Hungarian is replayed, so to speak, in what the man is saying, and he's parodying his own life as a wanderer, his own life in pursuit of some meaning that he cannot find. He's trying to find it through love, but it doesn't seem to point into that true direction. He's searching and searching, and all he can think about is the flower that is plucked, which is the obsessive theme of the lament that goes over and over again. So in other words, you'll have an inside track, and in a sense, you'll be an insider if you happen to look at the website, click on this lament, and actually look at the translation and see how everything that the lament is saying about the loss of a flower and going all over the world to try to find the flower again and recover its color and aroma, all of that is generated by the song. It has special meaning for the people who are involved in the narrative. It is not understood by those who are outside the narrative. And the whole story, with all of its flashbacks, is a way of going deeper and deeper into a sense of meaning through the wandering, through the that disequilibrium of not finding the right path, of trying to find the right path, of finding the ultimate goal. And that ultimate goal would be a word that we will explore the next time, which is a word that is telos, T-E-L-O-S, which means coming full circle. If you're uninitiated, it simply means the end. And did you hear how Catherine said when she finished her story, which you've been reading in Herodotus? She says, the end. Well, it's not the end in Herodotus, because it is precisely the story of Gyges, the bodyguard, and the queen, and their love affair, their illicit love affair, that then leads 5 generations later to the story of Croesus, and to the story of a loss of empire, to that crisis where people have to define what it is to be truly happy, or shall I say, olbios. Because this film, as I say, deals directly with the story, and in fact tells the story that we're studying, and our view is the concept of the hero, I think you really should see this, because it really will help initiate you from yet another angle, so to speak. While we're on the subject of angles, I had promised you that I would try to show you how this Odysseus theme of wandering with a symbol, and where the symbol changes meanings as you go from one place to another, and how that affects your own idea of meaning. Let's look at the modern Greek versions of this kind of story. Only here the star, so to speak, is not Odysseus, it's Saint Elias, or number 7, the prophet Elijah in the Hebrew Bible. In the Eastern Christian Church, a lot of the great prophets of the Hebrew Bible became saints. But what's more important, the folklore, which comes directly from the ancient world, interwove with these Christian categories. And what predominates here is the folklore. Variant 1. Saint Elias was a seaman who lived a dissolute life, but he repented of what he had done and thereby detested the sea. And then a sub-variant, because he had suffered much at sea and had often nearly drowned, he became disgusted with voyaging. He resolved to go to a place where people knew neither what the sea was nor what ships were. Putting his oar on his shoulder, he set out on land, asking everyone he met what he was carrying. So long as they answered that it was an oar, he proceeded to higher and higher ground. Finally, at the top of the mountain, he asked his question, and the people answered, "A stick." uninitiated, understanding then that they had never seen an oar, he remained there with them. Varian, too, the prophet Elias, was a fisherman who, because of terrible weather and terrific storms, became afraid of the sea. So he put an oar on his shoulder and took to the hills. When he met a man, he asked him what it was he was carrying. The man answered that it was an oar, and Elias went on. The same happened when he met a second man, but at the top of a mountain, he asked the third man, who replied, "Why, that's a stick." St. Elias resolved to stay there. He planted his oar in the ground, and that is why his chapels are all built on hilltops. And the prophet Elijah, what's his last moment in earthly life for the prophet Elijah? He is on top of a mountain, and a chariot of fire comes for him and then takes him off. So that's why the prophet Elijah, if I can give you that part of the story, is associated with mountains. But as far as ancient Greeks are concerned, the reason that mountains are so important is that that's one way to visualize how you can get as far away from the sea as possible. Number 8, the feast day of St. Elias in the Eastern Church coincides roughly with the harvesting season, and it's precisely at this moment that wheat is winnowed, which is what we're interested in. And there is a hero cult, and we're going to get more and more into the mechanics and the real historical background of hero cult next week, but there's a hero cult of Odysseus in Arcadia, which is as far away from the sea as possible. And there he's worshipped together with, look at this, Athena as goddess of pilots and Poseidon as god of the sea. So again, what do we see? God-hero antagonism in the context of a hero cult. And number 10, I'm going to have to draw a picture of this. There's a Greek custom, which is after you've finished winnowing your wheat, and you have a pile of genuine grains of wheat, then as a symbol of saying, it's finished, the harvest is finished, you plant your winnow shovel on top of the pile, okay? And that's the gesture, number 10. Now, I want you to compare that with the tomb of the sailor, as we see it described in number 11, which is, if you look at it from far away, it's a mound, and on top of the mound is planted the oar that the sailor used to sail the ship. So in other words, the picture that I've given you is really ambivalent. It has two messages. So it's the same on the two messages, isn't it? One message is, if you look at it from afar, you say, oh, what do I see there? Oh, I see a pile of grain and I see a winnow shovel, symbolizing that the harvest is done. Or, I see the tomb of a sailor, symbolizing that the sailor's journey is finally finished. So number 11, the same, if you like, the tomb, is one sign. But in another way, if you don't think of Sema as a tomb, this image, this Sema as an image, has the two meanings, which is the sailor is dead and the harvest is finished. Let us celebrate. So here we come to the basic fundamental religious idea of the death of a hero, which is the death of a hero as actualized in the corpse of a hero, which is planted in the local earth, is a talisman of fertility and prosperity for the community that worships the hero. The hero, precisely because he or she was unseasonal in life, once he or she achieves death, and if the story is a rich and full and completed and coming full circle story, will be the sacred force that guarantees seasonality even though the hero's own life was unseasonal. And this seasonality then is the ultimate sign, so to speak, of the seasonal forces of nature itself. And I would like you to think of these things as you look at 12 onwards, which is what you're discussing in section today, because the link, if I can say it that way, between my lecture today and what you're studying in the section this week is what it is to be Odios. On one sense, on a purely material level, it's simply being prosperous, being fortunate in material things of the world. But underneath that sense is the idea of the beatific status of a hero who has lived a full life, such as Telos, whose very name means coming full circle and being initiated and being complete and being seasonal after a life of unseasonality. And that religious meaning of a hero is what the Odyssey is already alluding to when it predicts the death of Odysseus, where he's supposed to plant an oar into the ground. When he reaches a point where he's as far away from the sea as possible, at that point, what he's planting into the ground is something bigger than either an oar or a winnowing shovel. It's part of the overall picture of what can happen to a hero after the full story is told. And that full story is the story of seasonality triumphant, where everything finally comes together, and where, and I think this is what's most comforting to us, meaning, the meaning of the hero, finally comes together. So stay tuned for more and richer meaning, and hope to see you tonight. Thank you.